This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm pleased to have in the studio with me David Masiotra, author of Working on a Dream, The Progressive Political Vision of Bruce Springsteen. David Masiotra, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I love the magazine and have listened to some of the podcasts before. They're great. I hope you can elevate me on your coattails today.
Oh, you're too kind. tell me a little bit about your background. Where'd you grow up?
Grew up in a little town south of Chicago called Lansing, Illinois, and graduated high school from Lansing, TF South Public High School, and shout out if anyone happens to listen. And then went to college at a University of St. Francis, which is in Joliet, Illinois, so south suburbs, and now I live in northwest Indiana.
And you're teaching now?
Yeah, I teach writing and English at the University of St. Francis, where I did my undergraduate work, as I just said.
How'd you get interested in this whole Bruce Springsteen? You seem a little too young to be a big Springsteen fan.
Oh, yeah, I know. Usually when I go to a concert, I'm the only young person around, but that's okay. It's an interesting story. I went in Lansing. I went to a small Lutheran grade school, and I was walking around the halls one day with a John Mellencamp CD. And the junior high principal, who was, unlike most principals at most school, he was a really likable guy. Everybody loved him, all the students included. He said, you know, if you like Mellencamp, you should check out Springsteen. So I did. I think I went to the video store and rented his video anthology and just fell in love with the songs. So,
and when did you decide to do a book on him?
That was a couple years ago. I went to the Art Institute in Chicago, and I went to the Edward Hopper retrospective, and I saw that an author wrote a book on Edward Hopper using Hopper's paintings as a predicate to get into socio-political issues and psychological issues. And I had always wanted to read a book like that using Springsteen's music, but no one had ever written one. So I said, well, I guess if I want to read it, and no one else is going to write it, I have to write it. So that's what I did, and yeah. I hope others read it and enjoy it.
That's a good way to get into something.
Right.
Write it because you want to read it. I'm speaking with David Masiotra. He's author of Working on a Dream, The Progressive Political Vision of Bruce Springsteen. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I was interested in finding out in this book that Springsteen actually, though he was born in a time that made him old enough to participate in the civil rights movement or anti-Vietnam War protests in the 60s, actually didn't. Why do you think he didn't? And give us a little bit about his background.
Well, I've actually discovered, I'll answer your question, but I discovered since the book came out that he did play at a rally for McGovern. So that was his first political activity, and he wasn't famous then. He was just a local musician. McGovern was in New Jersey. So that's a cool thing I've discovered. But yeah, by and large, he wasn't involved in any of the political protest movements or anything like that. He was a guy from working class town Freehold, New Jersey, and had a really kind of difficult childhood. His father was an oppressive figure, and his mother was very loving, and he didn't fit in to school or anything, and he was just kind of an aimless kid until he discovered he could play rock and roll. And he attributes that, religious language and all, to saving him. Rock and roll saved his life. So for a very long time, he had a myopic focus on rock and roll music because it saved him. It gave him a sense of purpose, a source for meaning. It gave him a community to belong to. You know, community of fellow musicians.
Gave him an identity outside his dad, or probably something his dad didn't like.
Right, exactly.
His dad was severe and always said, he jokes about his dad telling him to put the goddamn guitar down.
Right.
Springsteen in your book says, for a long time there, it was though my guitar was made by a company called Goddamn.
Right, no Fender, no Gibson, just Goddamn, yeah.
I love that. You call Springsteen America's Poet Laureate. Why?
Well, because Bruce Springsteen has an amazing, uncanny ability in his lyrics to speak to the triumphs and failures and suffering of everyday people in America, and do it in a way that's spiritually uplifting, psychologically engaging, in some cases sexually, motivating. And he does it across such a broad spectrum. There's a lot of songwriters, even though I've written a book on Bruce Springsteen, who I would say are just as good, maybe even better. You know, people like Bob Dylan, you know, Neil Young, some of his peers, I wouldn't dismiss as being below Springsteen. However, I think what sets Springsteen apart is how he seems to hit on every aspect of life and every aspect of the country. It's almost like Tolstoy or Balzac put into music. And in his concert, he calls it part circus, part dance hall, part political rally, and part spiritual meeting.
A revival meeting.
Yeah. So, you know, what else is left after that, Don?
Compare him to Dylan, because early on he was burdened with a comparison to mm-hmm. Dylan. You know, Newsweek and Time both saying, is this the next Bob Dylan there in the early mid-70s? And that seemed to be too much of a weight. It's like telling someone you're the next Michael Jordan. Who wants that? And a lot of people have that on them at the beginning and never live up to it. In a sense, he lived up to it. He carved out his own identity. He's different from Dylan in a lot of ways. Do you want to delineate a couple of that?
I think that's in his earlier work, his lyrics had a much more complex, constantly rhyming syntax to the lyrics and pattern to the lyrics. He talked about being with a rhyming dictionary on his bed and writing songs. But I think that's a lazy fallback for many journalists, music writers especially, tend to be very lazy in some of the monikers and categories they come up with. So, you know, Bruce Springsteen was the new Bob Dylan. People like John Mellencamp, you know, well, he's a Bruce Springsteen wannabe. I saw recently somebody wrote that Bob Seger is a Bruce Springsteen wannabe, but this person obviously didn't know that Seger started making music before Bruce Springsteen.
And so, Springsteen liked Bob Seger.
Yeah, so that seems unlikely that he was trying to be Springsteen, even though he had never heard of him. And I recently interviewed Daryl Hall from Hall & Oates, and he talked about the horrible appellation of blue-eyed soul. That, you know, it's just they had to come up with some way to categorize white people singing soul music. It can't just be soul music. So I think that burden was placed on him by lazy journalists constantly looking to find a way to define someone's identity for them instead of taking the time to understand what that person's really about. That being said, Bruce Springsteen responded to that, as you would imagine, with a lot of hostility, and he distanced himself from that. So the first album had that new Dylan label, and he abandoned that lyrical writing technique, and the second album is almost a jazzy rock technique. I mean, you can almost categorize it with Van Morrison or somebody like that. And then, of course, Born to Run has that famous wall of sound that people the world over have grown to love. So he part of it was just following his muse, I'm sure, and then another part was concentrating on finding his own identity and distancing himself from that new Dylan thing, even though he loved Bob Dylan, was inspired by him very much.
Speaking with David Masiotra, who's the author of Working on a Dream, The Progressive Political Vision of Bruce Springsteen. And in a way, Springsteen's embrace of politics, when he didn't embrace it early on, though you say now that he did play it at McGovern's, is the reverse of the way Dylan started, or Dylan's trajectory. Dylan was leader of the political folk movement, and then, you know, take this badge off of me, stop doing political stuff or overtly political stuff. Whereas Springsteen has involved himself politically over the course of his career. And I don't mean that mainstream politics, though we can talk about that more because he did that overtly later on. But, you know, you talk about his willingness to play at the No Nukes Conference in the late 70s, the Christic Institute, this group that was exposing the involvement of the U.S. government in helping the Contras destabilize the Nicaraguan government, run drugs with the CIA. Mm-hmm. That was a controversial thing. And also at every concert giving donations to food pantries and local right. shelters. This was a side of Springsteen that that he called human politics. Explain what he meant by the phrase human politics.
Human politics, it's a great phrase, and he used it to talk about a form of political activism that gets beyond the narrow electoral campaign system of our politics. We have a very campaign-centric way of viewing politics in this country, and these campaigns are covered as horse races or as athletic competitions. So if you want to be loyal to principles like economic and social justice, equality, liberty, inclusivity for minorities, and
fairness, basic fairness, too.
Basic fairness, yeah, and progressive politics is so much a part of that. If you want to be loyal to these principles and act on these principles, you have to get outside of this electoral system where it's about compromising to win and raising money. And he did this by doing things like you just said, playing benefit shows, aligning with charitable institutions and social policy institutions. And this was a way of connecting directly with the people in physical communities that he sang about and delineated in this spiritual community of his music.
And you quote him as saying, you know, sometimes he talks in concerts. I've seen him four or five times. I saw him in college in the late 1970s in Providence, Rhode Island, and several times since. And at some point in each concert I was at, and I guess a lot of the concerts, he does give a little rap about right. The concern of the day or yeah. some of
he
his
he calls basic. It a public service announcement.
Yeah, and you quote him in this book, David Masiatra, Working on a Dream. You quote him as saying, you know, if I've entertained people for a couple hours, they can listen to me for 2 minutes.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I think that's a great quote because, you know, it speaks to a cultural problem that I observe throughout America that results from this game show mentality and this, you know, so entertainment-driven culture. Now, rock and roll is entertaining, so I want to tread carefully here, but that unless I am being entertained, I shouldn't listen to this. I don't have time for this. I want instant gratification. I want reward for very little effort. And there's a lack of an internal life that many Americans have. And I see this in concerts, in Springsteen concerts. People walk out when he plays a new song or, you know, it's just they're treating him as a human jukebox. And he says, if I've, you know, worked very hard on stage for two and a half hours to entertain you, you should listen to me talk for a couple minutes about the concerns and issues that motivate my songwriting and that I feel are very important.
I like that human jukebox. I mean, a lot of very intelligent, talented writers, performers. I'm thinking now of the movie critic Roger Ebert. I interviewed him once on this show, and he said he got so sick and tired of people saying, don't you dare give me any of your political talk. Just review a movie, you know, just like they're a trained dog or something.
Right, right.
Just do your tricks, you know, and leave the rest out. And in a way, that's what a lot of, you know, the right wing says about Hollywood people. They shouldn't open their mouths except, you know, when they're being paid to act. And that is ridiculous and confining, obviously. But Springsteen early on had a problem because his music was co-optable. The message right. was ambiguous, too ambiguous in a way, so much so that during the Reagan years, Reagan himself could co-opt Born to Run or try, and George Will would too.
Yeah, Born in the USA. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the problem with that is implied by your question is that people weren't listening to the song because the chorus may say Born in the USA, but the verses tell a story about a guy sent to the Vietnam War, the same war that killed his brother, and he comes back home. He can't find a job. He can't find a place to fit into society. And the chorus, this cry of Born in the USA, is one of shame, one of anger, one of pain. So part of the problem was people weren't listening to the song itself. Another part of the problem is there was, I think, a very cynical campaign to co-opt this music because at the time he was so popular. And it was popular with a certain audience, a certain demographic, to bring ugly marketing language into this conversation. that was valuable to people like Reagan, you know, white working class people, many of which in the suburbs. And that's a voting block that, that he wants to speak to, Reagan, that he, you know, that he wanted to bring on board.
But to some extent, maybe Springsteen was complicit in some marketing problems as well, or his record company. I'm speaking with David Masiotra, who's author of Working on a Dream, The Progressive Political Vision of Bruce Springsteen. And you're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. By that, I mean, you know, the whole flag bit.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to add that that would be my third point, that even though that's true, that there were fans who didn't listen to the song and there were right-wing politicians and pundits who either ignorantly misinterpreted the song or attempted to co-opt the song cynically for their own purposes, you also had Bruce Springsteen posing next to a flag and wearing clothes that made him look like Rambo. It wasn't the most subtle and nuanced presentation of the song, and it certainly helped push people into that misinterpretation. So it's, you know, the connection between art and commerce is always murky and muddy, and it's full of contradictions. And this is a perfect example.
And Born in the USA almost leads right into the chant, USA, USA, USA.
Right.
So that's kind of weird. And yet when he became more overtly political later on, I'm thinking of his song 41 Shots. I mean, when he first played that, I believe, in New York City, there were mass walkouts during the song
right.
in the concert.
Yeah, that's a song about Amadou Diallo, who's a West African immigrant, and he came to New York City to study biology. His English skills were pretty poor, and he was stopped by the police. Giuliani had a stop-and-search racial profiling operation in practice in the Bronx, and the police thought he resembled a rapist. You know, he was black, and that's if you just want to be straight about it. And they asked him to identify himself. He didn't understand, and then finally once he began to understand, but he couldn't communicate verbally with them, he went to pull out his wallet, and the police fired on him 41 times and murdered him in the street, totally innocent man. Well, Springsteen wrote a very moving and powerful song about this horrific tragedy, and he was labeled and branded as anti-cop, and people walked out, and many police officers refused to work security at the shows. So yeah, that's a case where the message definitely was understood to be critical.
Yeah, there's no ambiguity there.
Right.
tell me if I'm wrong. I thought Springsteen was kind of fading into obscurity almost, or just a cult-like, in a smaller and smaller cult, and an aging cult, until right after 9/11. And then his album after 9/11 kind of brought him back to mass recognition and popularity. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I think it's fair, and I also think that he's beginning to fade into obscurity again, because part of it is because of the politics. I believe that his political activism has unfortunately alienated many people. I would argue with those people that they're making the wrong choice. But you know, like you said earlier, I'm 25, and I have one friend who listens to Bruce Springsteen. Most young people don't listen to Bruce Springsteen, so. Even though he's built a very strong legacy and his music will continue to inspire and uplift a certain group of people for a very long time after he's gone, if young people aren't listening to your music, there's a shelf life there,
right.
And he's reaching that point. But The Rising, the album after 9/11, did put him back into the mainstream for a period of several years.
Mm-hmm. And then he decided to join the Kerry campaign. What was behind that?
Well, yeah, like as I said earlier, he did his best to stay out of electoral politics for a very long time. And if you look at his politics, you mentioned the Christic Institute, and if you listen to his songs, he's certainly much further to the left than John Kerry. And, of course, the campaign that John Kerry was running, which was a centrist campaign. However, he said that that election was just too important to sit out because Bush was such a destructive and dangerous president. That, you know, somebody had to put a stop to this. And if it had to be John Kerry, then it was going to be John Kerry. You know, it may not represent the ideal, but it's certainly an improvement.
I remember seeing Bruce Springsteen play at a John Kerry rally in Madison, Wisconsin on West Washington Avenue. This was the week before the election. There were tens of thousands of people in the street here. It was a beautiful fall day, and everyone thought he was going to win. And but maybe it was the fact that he had to be in Madison that day was a suggestion that maybe he wasn't so secure in his victory because
right.
Madison's such a lock on liberal votes. But yeah, Springsteen was really putting himself out there. And I think he was right. You know, that Bush, Cheney were such a threat to our democracy, not that Kerry was any great shakes. And to me, one of the most moving songs that Springsteen has done in the last decade is the song Long Way Home. Tell us about that song. You know the song better than I do.
Long Way Home is on the 2007 album with the E Street Band called Magic. And it's a song about coming out of the destruction of the Bush years, the destruction to our democracy, destruction to our economy, and destruction to our communities. And in that song, he walks through his town and he doesn't recognize it. The protagonist in the song is walking through his hometown and he doesn't recognize it. You know, businesses are boarded up. The, you know, the Veterans Hall is empty. I think he says there's just a sign on it that says gone. And the people are unfamiliar too, because he senses that some of these people have forgotten the core values that shaped their community and they've somehow been lost. And the refrain of that song is, it's going to be a long way home. And that's about returning to the America that, you know, values freedom and values just the rule of law and basic good. And perhaps that place never existed as much as we like to tell ourselves it existed. But in the song, he talks about his father telling him that, you know, the flag hanging over the courthouse in the town square means there's things we do in this country and there's things we don't do.
And that's an explicit or an implicit but thinly veiled reference to the torture
right.
that the Bush administration was engaging
oh,
around
yeah.
the
torture,
world.
Torture, wiretapping, the excesses and abuses of the Patriot Act, all of it. It was very dark, and it's very depressing and discouraging to know that so much of it is continually practiced with yeah. a Democratic administration.
Well, that's the amazing thing about the Obama administration, Obama being someone who was a constitutional professor in constitutional law, and he's kept this edifice of repression that Bush and Cheney erected. He's kept it pretty much in place.
Right.
And now asserts the right to go assassinate American citizens
oh, yeah,
overseas.
It's very scary and very outrageous.
Yeah.
And then sometimes he plays games with semantics. I mean, he says we've ended the practice of torture, but we still practice rendition. So that's
yeah.
like outsourcing torture.
Yeah.
I'm not sure there's much of a moral difference
right.
there.
I mean, I hate to call it rendition because it's such a euphemism. I mean, it's kidnapping people and throwing them into a prison somewhere, though they have no access to any due process whatsoever. It used to be kind of the trademark of Guantanamo, and that's not down yet. But even if and when Obama shuts down Guantanamo Bay, he's got a forwarding address at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, and Obama's lawyers have gone into court saying, if we've got them there, there's no judge in America who can challenge us because
right.
it's beyond your reach. And that is essentially a Bush-Cheney argument.
Yeah.
And so to see that is very discouraging. You know, I saw Obama speak a while back in Madison, too. We get the candidates coming through and the president coming through. And, you know, he's still singing the Hope song.
Right.
And yet I noticed in your book that there's a long section on hope and Springsteen. Springsteen was into the hope thing long before Obama was into the hope thing. Talk about that and how he's able to preserve, even in these dark times, the idea that there's redemption and hope.
Well, hope is all about truth, and truth is all about allowing suffering to speak. That's a Cornel West quote, which is very applicable to this conversation. And hope is rooted in struggle. And Obama spoke in those terms during his presidential race during the Yes We Can speech, when he linked it to ending slavery, giving women the right to vote. And I saw that he did that. He's been doing that again recently. I have some problems with that now. He's no longer a candidate. He's president. You know, you have some responsibility now. You're not just in a preacher mode. But back to your question, hope is all about the struggle. And it's rooted in struggling on behalf of shared virtues in an edifying community, shared virtues of love, service, commitment to justice. And hope doesn't guarantee success, but it promises that progress will be made at a minimum on an individual basis if you remain committed to the struggle and you remain committed to the struggle with your own integrity intact.
I'm speaking with David Masiotra. He's the author of Working on a Dream, The Progressive Political Vision of Bruce Springsteen. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. It was kind of daring of Springsteen, it seems to me, to link up this idea of struggle that you've just been talking about with the traditional folk artists, with Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger. He didn't need to go there. These guys were condemned throughout the and blacklisted, condemned as communists, blacklisted in the 50s. Pete Seeger certainly was. And yet, Springsteen went out of his way to embrace them. What was behind that?
Yeah, he even did a tribute album to Pete Seeger and a tour where he played many of Pete Seeger's songs and some of the more benign songs like Jacob's Ladder, even though that's rooted in a political struggle. The lyrics have just a spiritual context. And some of the more explicitly political songs like Bring 'Em Home, which is an anti-war ballad. I think that Bruce Springsteen fits into that tradition very well of the balladeer and the troubadour speaking to the conditions of everyday people and distancing himself from power and using his art as a weapon against injustice and a tool for organizing everyday people. And he learned that from guys like Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie, so he acknowledged it.
Yeah,
and,
Woody Guthrie said, "My guitar had on his guitar, this guitar kills fascists."
Right, right. And that's, you know, that's very instructive for artists and activists to voluntarily enlist into a community built on the tradition of those who served that community before.
David Masiotra, there's one rap against Springsteen, and that is that, you know, he's gotten all millions and millions of dollars, and he's super rich. He lived in California for a while, married an actress. You know, how can he keep talking about working class people? He doesn't live that life anymore. It's a pose.
Yeah, that's the rap used against many Hollywood actors too. And I think it's very cynical and disingenuous to suggest that anyone who's rich can no longer be concerned about those that aren't. His upbringing was working class, and he still prioritizes working class people. And we see that not only in his art, but in these political movements and charities that he involves himself with. And plus, you know, it's important to remember that he made his money, and people like Sean Penn or Brad Pitt or whoever, they make their money with their creativity. They make their money as artists. And I don't want to idealize them and say that they're always doing the integrity move. But they make their movie doing something and creating something that brings joy and meaning to many people's lives. You know, they're not hedge fund managers. So we have to make a distinction between different kinds of millionaires. There's people who give edifying art to millions of people, and then there's people who, you know, just destroy our economy. You know, it's not the same thing.
Right. We barely have 20 seconds left. I just wonder if you think there's anyone out there right now in this kind of Springsteen lineage tradition.
Young artists?
Yeah.
There's plenty. And there's many hip-hop artists who do this, people like Immortal Technique and Common and Talib Kweli. But the problem is they're underground. They've been pushed mm-hmm. underground, and there's no longer an infrastructure to support politically outspoken artists.
Well, I hope maybe on the internet that can be generated and democratized in a way, and, you know, to hell with the fame-making machinery, and let's just do it ourselves. David Masiotra, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
David Masiotra is the author of Working on a Dream, The Progressive Political Vision of Bruce Springsteen.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.